Hello, my name is Matatle Stofile. I am the contributing beauty editor at Wanted. Today I'm sitting with author, model, global advocate for mental health worldwide. She's also a podcast host and she is a champion for many women and children. She also happens to be former Miss South Africa, Shudufatso Musida. Right, so I don't know if actually this is going to sound like much of a beauty conversation to anybody because my idea of beauty has certainly evolved over the years. And as I get older, and I think I would say today, it certainly skews towards how you feel about yourself, the decisions that you make every day, the person that you're becoming. Are you sleeping well at night? Is your nervous system in check and regulated? Those are the things for me that make me feel beautiful and make me feel like I'm in the right path, you know, in my life. I don't know if you have a definition of beauty where you are right now, how you look at the concept of beauty.
So for me, beauty is trusting yourself, because the conversations that I've been having are very much about being able to speak up about your boundaries, speaking up even when you feel like people will leave you. Because I feel like as women, for the most part, it has always been very much of the person that holds everything together, but you don't, what holds you together? And then you look at the different beauty standards that are very external. It's constantly moving goalposts. You're too big. You're too small. Your hair should look like this. Our black hair is considered ugly, or what do they call this?
Coarse
and like not elegant and all these things. There's just always so many moving goalposts. But the ability to trust who you are, what you bring to the table, trusting what you see, because sometimes we look at ourselves in the mirror and depending on the standards of the day, the things we say to ourselves are like not very constructive. So for me, beauty has become trusting myself in what I say, how I show up, what I bring to the table. Some days it'll be 10%, but I trust that 10%. Some days it'll be 100%, but I trust that 100%. So it's trust.
I want to talk about your name. Shudufatso. Am I saying correctly?
Shudufatso.
Okay, great. Now, when I was growing up, when I was still quite a small girl, I did not like my name. It was, I wanted a simpler name that just rolled off the tongue, and Matatle, and having to always correct people when they say my name for the first time and people asking me what it means. It was too much. I just wanted a very simple, lovely, easy name. Until my father sat me down and he explained the meaning behind my name and he explained the context in which that name was given to me. And then I grew a sense of appreciation for it. And I love my name. And in fact, when I meet people for the first time, I always insist that they call me by my full name until we know each other better. Because there's big meaning behind it. How do you feel about your name? And I want to know, has anyone in your family ever sat you down and given you a clear context of how you were given your name? And what does it mean?
It's so beautiful that you're bringing that up, because I was having a conversation on an episode that I had with a dear friend of mine, Dr. Tebe Ikalifeng, and we were speaking about identity on the African continent and how a lot of us growing up would always use our second names, you know, the English name that you were given, because it was always easier. But there's a story behind every name. There's a reason why you were given your names. Your name. And the beauty of being African is that there's always a story behind who you are. And I love the story that you just shared now about your father. With my name specifically, so at home in Venda, they call me Abby. So it's short for Abigail, but right. They used to call me Abby. That's the name I grew up with. You know, you just accept it and you move on. I never really thought about my name as anything of significance. Never really, you know, like Abindi Abby. And then I moved from the village to a school in Mpumalanga, an English school. And it was, I think it was like one of the first, I didn't notice it in grade 3 until I was in grade 4 after having been bullied. And one of my teachers, they do roll call as they let you in class. She's like, shoo, shoo, shoo. And this woman got so flustered. She's like, Musida. She didn't want to, I'm like 9 years old at that point. She didn't want to say my name or try to. I'd prefer you butchering it and trying, but like, I didn't think it was a thing. But the shame I felt when she couldn't say it was something that stayed with me for such a long time. And every single time I'd go to different classes and they'd do the same thing. I think it was like 6 months later. As soon as they, before they'd actually get to my name, because I knew who was like right after, who was right before me, I'd say, I'm here. Just to avoid that feeling.
That dismissal also.
That dismissal. That exactly. Because it feels like a dismissal of your identity. Mm-hmm. And like it bothered me for such a long time, but it was very much, then it became tied to the identity of who I am. Dimu Venda ve, like I'm literally from Venda. And there was something like that, her dismissal of my name or their dismissal of my name made me feel ashamed of myself. And I liked my second name because then I would find the meaning of that just to give myself, you know, that thing of like, I matter. And only when I was 21, I read this book by Don Miguel Ruiz, The Four Agreements. And it speaks about how a lot of us think we have freedom until we actually understand that we didn't even choose our own names. So if you were to decide what you're called today, what would it be? Mm-hmm. And the first thing that came to my mind, honestly, was Shudupadz. It wasn't Abigail. If I had to decide what I'm called, it was Shudupadz. It was like, I remember reading it, I was 21, and I was like, we live in a world where we can decide who we want to be, what we want to be called, what we want to be identified as. And for me, it was Shudupadz. And then I found out, okay, my mom will always tell me the story that I was named by my dad's cousin. When I was born, it was raining, like pouring with rain. And he's someone who works at church, and he said, her name will be Shudupadz Ongor Ori Shudupadza. So my name means blessing. We were blessed by this blessing from God. Yeah. My second name, Abigail, means God's daughter, God's child.
Right.
So my names have very strong meanings, but my name, Ushudupadza, Shudupadzo, like became something that I carried with me. So when I even entered Miss South Africa, for example, I could have chosen what was easier because I knew for years people say shu, 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 you know, and they never like get through it. And I have the same rule. When we meet, I want you to call me by my full name. Once you've made the effort of saying my name, then you can call me Shudu. But when I entered Miss South Africa, I was like, you know what? If I'm to show up to the world and the world is going to know my name, this is the name that they're going to know.
Amazing.
All however many letters, 11 to 13, I've stopped counting. But it was such a significant thing to me to know that in everything that I do, because Ngachivenda, in my language, Madzina Amba, which means our names tell stories. They define who we're going to be. And our definition or how we understand our names to mean are the identities we assume as people. So that was like such an important thing to assume, my full name.
That's great. All right. That's great. I want you to, I love that. I resonate with it so much. And you put it so well when you said the shame that hits you when someone can't say your name and then the immediate dismissal. And then for me, they just suggest a shorter version or I'm going to call you such and such. And also because I don't have an English name, I had the kind of parents who said, you want an English name, go and find an English girl with a closer name and you can swap. And that was never going to happen. So it was kind of like, why would we do that? You're not getting an English name. So that is such a powerful background to your name. Take me back to 8-year-old Shudu in that small village in Limpopo. Can you describe her and tell me just what was the environment like? What did she feel? Who was she?
She was a carefree girl. That's my favorite version of myself, actually. That I think to this day, the older I get, I like the version of me now because I'm very confident in the person I've become. But 8-year-old me, 7-8-year-old me was such a, she didn't have much, but she had so much. My 8-year-old self taught me how to dream and that every dream that I dream will actually come true. My 8-year-old self thought she had magic powers. So I don't know if you remember Passions. It was a show that played on ETV at 4 p.m.
No.
But then it had a witch. Her name was Tabitha and she had a little like doll that she turned human to me. But they would cast spells that in Winx Club, right? And the reason I thought I had magic powers was because I could change any situation around me.
This is fascinating to me because, oh my, I don't want to interrupt
you. No, carry on.
Because one of my questions I was going to ask you later on in our chat was, do you have any superpowers? Mm. But the story you're telling now is so fascinating to me. And please don't lose your train of thought, because I tell my husband this all the time. I say, you know, people talk about manifesting. When I was a little girl, I thought this was a normal thing. Mm. I had that magic. I could just change any situation. Literally. And it was a very easy, energetic thing that I could do. And I don't know at what point I kind of, it fizzled and it became a lighter version of that, until at some points I just think that I can't even do it. But please continue, because I knew every little girl had this superpower.
But what you're saying is quite interesting, because we always think we've lost it.
Yeah.
I don't think we do, because I'm living in prayers I prayed when I was 8. I knew God when I was 8 because I knew the source of my superpower was God. So I'd have Psalm 23 on my door. And I remember the first time I thought I had magic powers, I'd watch TV a lot. So how I learned how to speak English was TV. And I would sit there, and I remember seeing First Wives Club and these Diane Keaton, Barbara, I always forget her surname.
Streisand?
No, it's not Streisand.
I know this movie. Is this where they're all...
Yeah, you don't like, know
the
me.
Single women. And
yeah,
yes, yes.
Them. So I watched it and I'm like, I'm going to end up in New York. I'm going to be a woman in a white suit who can take care of herself, who can afford anything. But most importantly, I'm going to have fun like those women. And that became something that I think from there, I would watch wrestling and be like, they'll be like, live from Madison Square Garden, live from this place. I'm like, I'm going to go there. I'm going to go there. Mind you, I'm sitting on the floor, grandfather's house. There's gravel road outside. When I traveled to Joburg, I used the bus, you know, like literally there was nothing around me that could indicate that I could ever achieve those things. But for me, I have magic powers.
You didn't know anyone who'd ever been to New York?
No one in my family had actually been on a plane. I didn't know anyone who'd actually done that. And I just remember dreaming anyway. And I'd spend a lot of time by myself reading books. But every time I'd sit, I have this thing where I'd like squint my eyes a little bit and it'd get a little bit blurry.
Oh my gosh.
And then I would imagine that I'm like shifting things, Matilda, like Matilda vibes. And I just thought I had magic powers. So everything that I would manifest, I knew, I'm calling it manifestation, but I was like, I'm willing this into existence. Yeah. And even when I'd lose money, I made a video, like if someone asked me, how do I know God is real, right? But because I would lose money, literally flipping couches with both my hands, start crying, and then I'd sit, because I'd be sitting by myself. I was always by myself. I'd be like, God, I really need to find this money. As I'm crying, I'd open my hand and the money's there, that 2 rand coin. And the crazy thing about that was that it showed me that like our minds are incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And the 8-year-old version of me is my reference point of that. When I say I live an evidence-based life, is because everything I wanted when I was 8, the things I dreamt, the things I wrote down, the things I would pray for every New Year's, that 8-year-old version of me is my favorite version of me. And when I try to tap into a higher version of myself, it's my 8-year-old self.
It's so interesting to say this, because I'm in my 40s and I have found that probably since my late 30s, I started remembering my younger self a lot more and really, really tapping into that energy and just remembering things that I'd completely forgotten.
Mm.
Things that mattered to me, the superpowers I had, things that used to thrill me, how much I loved nature and how I'm a small town / village girl myself, and how I would spend long days, hot days, just lying on the grass and completely connecting with the ants, with the soil, staring at the sun for hours, the clouds, you know, and how much joy and comfort that stillness used to bring me. I'm so glad I chose the age of 8 for you to describe yourself, because I do think that it is a magical age. You're just old enough to be conscious, to remember what is happening, even when you're older, to kind of tap back into. But you're also young enough to just be completely untainted, and you feel whole. You feel like your whole true self, nothing. So it's interesting that in my 40s, I'm really, really also trying to tap back into the magic of that younger girl.
Mm.
When was the first time you were aware of social responsibility? Like, where did that sense of social responsibility come from for you? When did that start?
I think social responsibility, as in caring for like humanity.
As in caring for others and also feeling like it is a responsibility of yours. Like feeling like it is something that you need to do something about. Because we can all see injustices, but some people, it just doesn't hit them as hard as others. And others make it their life's mission or their life path to actually try and address that, which is what you have done. So I wonder, has it always been there? Did someone around you, I mean, I don't know, the role of women maybe in your community, where did it come from?
I think for me, like the role or the responsibility I feel towards others is not something that came, but I think maybe it was something that I was born with because of the family that raised me. I was raised by people who didn't owe me anything. So my mom had me when she was 18. My aunt had her own children. My grandmother was busy with other things. My great-grandmother had other things to do. But somehow I was raised by people who could have said, no, it is your responsibility. You don't get to go to school, telling my mom. But they allowed my mom to go to school. And they raised me with so much love. Like my favorite human being was my great-grandmother, because after school, she was old. We'd say we're hungry and she'd sit there and she'd just make us food. You know, you go to any person's house and there's always food to eat. And we didn't have much like growing up. But the other thing was my grandmother. She was on social grant and there was a girl next door who lived next to us, and she would get her school shoes. She would help with food here and there. But this is like, social grant is not a lot of money. It's like 300 or whatever.
Yeah.
But she ensured that any child, even my aunt did the same thing, they can come into our house and they can eat with us. And for us, it's not like, why is this person here? You never ask those questions because, you know, we're all family here, you know. But then the other thing was just watching things that had been normalized, because I've always been very self-aware and very observant. There were so many things that didn't make sense to me. Like you see someone who's sick and people are gossiping about it, and I'm like, that makes no sense. Like, why would you gossip about someone and like gossip about the fact that someone's probably dying? You know, like things like that. Instead of helping them, you know, instead of making them feel like they're part of a community. Why is it that an 11-year-old is raising her two brothers? That makes no sense. Why is it that this woman comes here with bruises on her face and no one is asking any questions? We just sit and it's business as usual. Like, there were so many things, even when I was 6 or 7, like we'd sit there and I'm like, this makes no sense. You know, like I'm a person that looks, and I'm like, this makes no sense to me, you know? And it was just something that I was always vocal about. Like a lot of people in my personal life know that if I see someone who I know has like done something, mistreated their employees, I don't care who you are, like I will say something. And that has now trickled over into policy and structural changes in our society, where for me, whatever I do in life, if I'm only doing it for myself, it means nothing. If I'm the only one rising, it means nothing. How do we lift others as we rise? Because I just don't think it makes sense for one person who has an abundance of food, who has an abundance of everything, to sit there while the next person next to them has
nothing.
Nothing.
I mean, we say, I usually reflect on this, and it's another mini superpower I consider myself to have been privileged to have, is the exposure of so many different lifestyles growing up in South Africa. So, you know, I definitely had the village experience, with my grandmother's village being less than 10-minute drive away from our small town where we lived and grew up, to being a boarding school child, to living in the city, to being able to travel overseas. So all these very different realities. But the one thing I keep remembering growing up, when I was, you know, before the age of 10. So growing up in a very small town / village, was nobody was homeless. Nobody starved. Everyone belonged to someone. Someone claimed you. It doesn't matter, you know, who you were. There were a lot of mentally ill people who were in the village, and everybody knew that this person is not okay, but they were always taken care of. And that was, for me, I think, one of the bigger culture shocks moving to a big city as I became, you know, a boarding school child, was just how easy it was for people to laugh at things like, oh, this one's parents have more money than this one. This one is on scholarship because why would that be funny? Or this one is not well, or, mm-hmm. you know, what exactly the examples that you were giving. It's so interesting to me. So I wonder, what are some of the values and even just things that, you know, growing up in Limpopo, you've had to shed off as you move to the city, but also which are the things you're still holding on to and feel like you have to hold on to in order to hold on to yourself also?
I don't think there are any values that I've shed off. Mm-hmm. I think I always joke with my friends and say, I'm so happy that I was raised by my aunt and my mother, because even when they're not close to me, before I do anything, any decision that I make, whether it's good or bad, their voices are always in my head. Mm-hmm. When you are in New York or even LA, the first time I was there, even if I'm calling reception or room service, I cannot help but say, hi, how are you? Thank you, please. Even though in the US, they'll be like, how can I help you? They don't want to answer how they are. They just want to get on with it. I cannot continue a conversation without
having
so us. I'll be like, hi, how are you? How can I help you? How are you? How are you?
Great.
Like, until they will say, I'm good. They don't even say, need to say it back to me. But like, I just, like, I need you to know that I'm like, I don't know. Like, I just don't know how to do those things. And I think the US is one of those, let's just get it done. Yeah. So I have adopted, let's get it done mentality, but I just can't lose my basic manners.
Right.
I cannot do it. So I don't think that there are any values that I've shared. I would say that I've just grown more into myself, and subscribed less to, I guess, the cultural pressures on women that come from being in a village.
Yeah.
Because the thing about the village is, like you're saying, everything that you said, no one is homeless. Everyone is taken care of. It's a beautiful place, but it's also a place where gender roles are still a very big thing, mm-hmm. that a woman is expected to act in this way. You know, like she's supposed to do this. She's supposed to, there's a lot of that. I just could never do them since I was a child. And thankfully I had a grandfather who just gave me space to be, but I've let go of feeling shame that I don't subscribe or prescribe to like the gender roles or any idea of what a woman is supposed to be, when she's supposed to get married, when she's supposed to have children. You know, I'm very ambitious. Yeah. And I speak my mind, and whatever situation, be it personal, be it career, be it romantic, I find myself in, is very much, I can never shed that about myself, but it's not a shedding. It's something that I've grown into, and I have loved not feeling shame for that and how I show up. But the fundamental values of who I am, I don't think I can change that, because I don't think it changes as you get higher in your career or like getting older.
Mm-hmm.
I think you just start understanding the value of those values as you get older.
You've talked about being bullied as a young child. I think you said in an interview you were bullied for 7 years.
Mm.
What do you wish you understood about yourself then that you fully understand about yourself now that would have been helpful to that child who was going through that?
That there's nothing wrong with me. That bullying, the people who are bullying me are the people that have something wrong with them.
Mm.
They're the ones that need the help. They're the ones that live in anguish.
Yeah.
Because bullying is usually a reflection of the other person and whatever turmoil is in them. So because a lot of people have not been given the vocabulary to express, or even the safety to express their feelings, they might be going through stuff at home. They might be victims in different way of different ways, like of bullying. It's learned behavior. And, you know, you just get this little girl who's, you know, too nice. And then you like, that's my target. I just wish then I knew that it wasn't a me thing, literally, because once you know that, it changes so much about how you see yourself.
So many of us, I think more recently and more, I feel like it's happening really quickly as well, especially in Africa, but just Black people all over the world also, not just in the continent, people of color. There's certain things that we are all kind of returning to because of our DNA memory, I think. Just when it comes to our well-being, our holistic well-being, there are certain things that we may have let go of and are now returning to, because somewhere in us we remember our grandmother's relationship with water and the sun and the moon and food and medicine. I wonder how in your work, in the work that you do as a global advocate for mental health, but also just being this champion for women and children, how do you intersect spirituality, culture, mental health? Those three things, is it something that you're conscious of doing? Do you find that they always do intercept? Just talk to me more about that.
I think they're always, in a way, they're always interlinked, because even if you're working as a global champion for women and girls, you find that what the role, or how mental health is perceived in the Middle East is very different to how mental health is perceived in Africa, how it's perceived in North America or Europe. So you find that you need to adapt to that in every space that you walk in. So I've mentored women and girls in Africa, the Middle East, and Europe. And you find that when you go to the Middle East, they, like the way they dress, the way they show up is very much informed by the homes they come from, the culture or the cultural nuances within, you know, their religion. So even when you're having a conversation, it's not as easy as just saying, follow your dreams. Like, that's not the environment they grew up in. So yes, follow your dreams, but then you're trying to get them to a different country to experience something, but then their families don't allow them to travel alone, like young women to travel alone. And if they do, like, there's a lot of nuance to it, you know? And then Africa, same thing. You're not just going to take a 16-year-old girl to go somewhere. Like, it's literally conversations. You need to ask your parents, all of that. Whereas in the US, a child can just say, Mom, I'm leaving. I'm going, you know? So I had a conversation about the intersection between African spirituality and mental health, or African spirituality through the lens of mental health, or mental health through the lens of African spirituality, a few months ago.
I saw that. That was fascinating.
And it was important to me, because when I started in the mental health space, I was like, I know there are people who have callings, you know, I may not necessarily understand the inner workings of it, but the people who have gone from being very, very sick, almost like, yeah, like you could say that they've got a mental illness, and then they respond to whatever spiritual calling or African spirituality calling that they have. And those people are fine. And then there are people who are just genuinely, they've been diagnosed with a mental illness that can resemble the calling. And the first time I had the conversation was with this white woman, actually, who said they've, at one of the universities that she went to, they've had to like learn. She took a course where they had to learn how to differentiate between a calling and a mental illness. And very few places can do that, where you can just give medication. That person will never get better, because maybe that's not why they're there. Maybe people have just misunderstood what they're looking at. And it's difficult, because like the way the medical industry has been shaped, or even mental health has been shaped, is through a Western lens. I think it's only the Eastern region that has had their own practices in terms of like healing cancer, mental illnesses, autoimmune diseases. They've done such a good job in the East. I'm speaking specifically about India. And I know a lot of people that have gotten so much healing there from autoimmune diseases, chronic illnesses. And that is something that I'm fascinated with, and I will be exploring as soon as I graduate. Mm. But it was such a beautiful thing to me. But then it got me thinking, why is it then that African modalities and African spirituality and African practices are always vilified and deemed as unworthy of respect and even academic research? But then again, having seen it, having heard it, having like respected the stories, I was like, these things are interlinked. And the only way you can heal someone is to know their story. But with Africans, our stories come with our ancestries. They come with, in English, they'll say, oh, it was hereditary. It's generational. You're basically saying it came from my ancestors.
Sure.
But then when we say it as Africans, it's seen as dirty.
Demonic.
Demonic. And for me, I'm an academic, you know, like I'm also a very spiritual person. And it would be stupid to just say something is demonic. Why are you saying something is demonic without actually researching it?
Mm.
And that's when I actually got someone who validated those thoughts where, like, I am also someone who's very religious.
Right.
But all of these things are stemmed from, like, Western ideologies, very real ideologies, very real diagnoses. But with Africans, there's certain things that work for Africans. Certain ways of looking at spirituality, mental health through the African lens, which is why I chose to have a Black therapist who's going to understand my Black experience
right.
and my mental health through that lens and the responsibility and the weight of being a Black woman coming yeah. from a Black family. And same thing with there's times where I sit down and the problems that my Caucasian counterparts have are very different from mine.
Yeah.
The things they deem important sometimes they're not that important to me. The things they think are like life, my life is shattering, it's breaking. Right. For me, sometimes it's not even that. But that's when you realize that in the medical fraternity, specifically mental health, it can't be a one-size-fits-all. It's impossible.
No, it can't. Our context and our perceptions and our backgrounds are so different. Even our environments are so different. The plants we live among are just completely different. And it certainly can't be a one size fits all.
Mm.
Okay, we're going to go somewhere lighter. You have spoken about Zozibini Tunzi as being someone who changed the perception you had of pageants.
Mm.
Can you tell me more about that? And I don't even know if they still call them beauty pageants or it's just pageants, but would you advise your little sister would you encourage her to enter a pageant and tell me how Zozi changed that? What was the perception you had before and how did she change it for you?
Pageants are very much like, I just saw long hair. Very model sized body shapes and stuff. And I remember watching them and just felt like this is not something for me because I can barely handle long hair. I could barely put on makeup. And the perception that was set was very much, unless you've got the long wavy hair, and it's a very westernized look.
Yeah.
Then you can't do, a pageant. And then when she, won Miss Universe, because I didn't watch the Miss South Africa pageant. When she won Miss Universe, I saw the clips specifically of like that moment. And what was beautiful for me was seeing someone with hair like mine,
yeah,
looking like beautiful, because even her makeup, the way it was done, it was not heavy. It was yeah. just her and a beautiful skin and a beautiful hair. And that was such an important moment because, again, it's representation, which matters a lot. Would I allow my little sister
or encourage her
or encourage? It's her choice. Like with my little sister, she's got her own mind. She's very stubborn. So like it's her choice. With my daughter, it's not something that I would encourage. No. But if that's what she wants to do, then she can do it.
Right.
Yeah.
You've been in New York now a year?
Two years.
Mm. 2 years and you're doing your master's and you've spoken about some of the culture shocks, some of the culture shocks, like the non-greeting back.
Mm.
It's funny. So my parents lived in Berlin for a few years and my mother used to tell me about how every time she takes the bus, she would sit next to somebody and she would start small talk and they would just look at her, get up and change seats every time. But she also never stopped. I was like, you need to stop talking to these people. But are there any other... what else have you learned from just the culture of being there that is so different from, so for example, I mean, one thing my friends and I always love about is how Americans have no problem being loud and wrong. The blind confidence. I've also heard you talk about this. What are some of the positive things you are learning from the American culture that we might be surprised to, I don't know, to realize as South Africans?
The big thing is definitely the blind confidence. Being in America is so interesting because they'll say things so confidently even when they're wrong.
Uh-huh.
But I think when you compare that to South Africans, even when you're right, we don't speak up enough. So I really, that's taught me a lot about just rolling with it. And if I'm wrong, I learn something. And if I'm not, great. But like they just speak with so much confidence. And at first you can make fun of it, but it's something that I honestly, honestly admire so much. How you can confidently say something. And even when you're wrong, you just brush it off. You just brush it off and tomorrow you do the exact same thing. I think that's why America is so big with motivational speakers. Some motivational speakers should not be motivating anyone. But because they sound so right, people buy into it.
Where I was going to say the danger lies, isn't it? And I suppose you have the advantage of being South African, so you can actually know where the line is. Because it's one thing to just be so blindly confident. I mean, it borders on the line of just being intolerant for some Americans, where they can't hear somebody else speak because they're so convinced of their own truth that they cannot hear anybody else's or even recognize it or even see it. But I suppose you have the advantage of coming from a different place and you can learn and take out what you need from there, but still maintaining, you know, the ability to know when it's gone too far.
But I feel like also value your time. By that, I mean, if you're sitting with someone who's so convinced of their own truth, why are you debating with them? I sometimes think it's like in America, there was this woman who I was sitting with. We were at it was a dinner. And she's educating me, a South African, about amapiano, telling me where it came from.
And that's what I mean. So if you were both Americans, that would go on and on and on and on and on. But because you're South African, you can go, okay, I'm not doing this.
No, but at first I tried and eventually I was like, you're right. Everything you're saying, you are right. But I think that's the thing about, to your point, coming from a different culture, I can say, it's fine. You're right. I don't, to be fair, I've never, for me, life is not about being right.
Yeah.
I feel like they just do it more, like they're being intolerant in terms of like standing in their own truth.
Right.
But I feel like people here at home do it too. Well, you're sitting there and it's a group of people and they're debating about a subject matter that they have no business debating about.
Oh, yeah.
And then they'll speak so confidently, even about other people. And respectfully, you are the idiot if you sit there trying to debate with people who from the start of the conversation to the end of the conversation have, it's like the blind leading the blind, literally. Yeah. But what I learned, I think even from being in SA, you sit there, at first you'll like debate or whatever, but if you're so fixated on being right, you will be in that loop for hours. She just had to do that for 5 minutes. She did that for 5 minutes, not even 5 minutes, maybe three.
Yes.
And she was explaining it, telling me, and I'm like listening to this person. I was like, and I eventually was like, you know what?
I'm like, oh, I see what's happening here.
And then I was like, it's fine. I don't. And to be fair, like you're saying, your mom would go to Berlin and she'd try small talk.
Yes.
I can't stand small talk. So I'd also be one of those people that stands up and leaves. But I wouldn't stand up and leave. Being South African means I'll sit there and take it. But that's what I also learned. Like there are times where people will want to have a conversation with you and they're not making sense, but they're so convinced that they're right.
Yeah.
And then you're just like, you know, you just learn the skill of just, cause that happens. It happens a lot. It happens a lot. But the US is just one of those places where you just learn to laugh about it. There was a guy in one of my classes. He said something and because I know him and we're cool, I repeated what he said and everyone just laughed because we were all thinking the same thing. So that's something that comes with it where you just learn to not take it too seriously.
Yeah.
Cause that's just how they are.
So from being a wrestling lover, playing with the boys when you were little, it sounds like you grew up, you had your tomboy stage, as we all did.
Yeah.
Would you say now there are any rituals you love doing just to make yourself, to ground yourself, but also to feel beautiful, or even products that you keep reaching for because you've now discovered the joy in, I don't know, grooming and being a little bit girly and feeling pretty.
I love a good mask. So my favorite mask is from all their masks, actually. Shiseido?
Shiseido? Japanese kind of Shiseido.
I love it so much. So that's like my favorite thing. Even when I'm on a plane, having it on.
Nice.
Makes me feel good. I love how it feels.
Those sheet masks.
Those sheet masks, yes. Yeah. So I have it under my eyes sometimes, or I have the full one.
Yes.
And they have this nice thing where you can secure it. Almost like you just got a facelift.
Oh.
Then you just put it over your
ears. Oh, yes, and you hook it.
And then you hook it and then you've got the whole thing going on. So that's quite lovely.
Do you keep it on the whole flight?
No, not the whole flight. I'll keep it on maybe an hour before I land.
Okay.
And then the other thing I love, which is not like necessarily a beauty secret, but reading makes, calms my nervous system. Mm. So when my nervous system is calm, I can actually take pleasure in doing the small things like my skincare routine. I think when your nervous system is not calm, you rush through everything. You just want to be done with everything, constantly moving on to the next thing. So something that I did was started reading Chimamanda again, and it calmed my nervous system so much that I could actually walk slowly to the bathroom, wash my face, and just really take my time with it. Notice that my skin looks nice, and then put a nice mask, or even when you're moisturizing, just seeing how hydrated your skin is. But when your nervous system is not calm, it's a weird beauty secret, but I think it's a real one. But when your nervous system is not calm, you don't sleep well. You rush through everything. So reading calms my nervous system, which allows me to actually enjoy.
That's a great little thing. I have found, I started this a few years ago as well, and I would feel my cortisol levels just going up, and I am just stressing for nothing, and I can just feel it. You know, the train is running with me, and I would say it out loud. I'd say, slow down. And I'd go to the bathroom and I'd start washing my hands, but very slowly and consciously, just trying to bring my mind back. And that's exactly the same sensation and feeling that I would get. It would feel like I've just reset my nervous system. And now I can do it with my breath also. Just slow down. And then as soon as I do slow down my breath, it feels like my whole body has reset.
Mm.
Which brings me to my last question, which is, you had an interview with Zureida.
Mm.
Oh, my love. I hadn't seen her in so long. And when I saw that episode, I was like, oh, my gosh, I used to love this lady. And you guys talked about the relationship you have with stillness.
Mm.
And just please just very quickly tell me what your relationship with stillness is, just what it does and what it means. Just talk a little bit about that. I found it so resonant, and just one of the things I was talking about that we seem to have forgotten but inherently know we need to do. And when you do it, it's almost like a spark of remembrance in your body, and it just feels so natural and also so healing. So what is your relationship with stillness?
So funny enough, I was actually speaking about stillness in one of the meetings I had before coming here. And my mentor was saying that stillness is the absence of movement. Stillness is knowing that you are held and firmly are where you need to be. And after stillness comes surrender. Surrender comes with calmness, which is movement, vigorous movement, but not without direction.
Mm-hmm.
So you're calm in all that movement because you were still enough before to know which direction you're going into. So one of the first conversations I had about stillness was with Rudisani Ravere.
Mm-hmm.
And she says stillness is not the absence of direction, but it's determining the way in which you're supposed to go. So my relationship with stillness is it gets me off the hamster wheel to walk at my own pace, but know where I'm walking to. Where the absence of stillness is going, but with no direction, because we think movement means we are walking towards something.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you could be walking towards burnout, your own downfall, like a hospital stay.
Mm.
But stillness allows us to know that, okay, when I stand up from here, I'm going to that door. Then you stand at that door, like the same way you are, if you're walking across the street, you need to look left, look right. You need to stand still first, look left, look right, and then walk across. That's stillness to me.
Mm.
But most of the time, we just go. Imagine walking past Sandton Drive at 4 p.m. and not stopping to look where you're going. Right. You're going to get hit by a car.
Right.
And stillness is taking stock. Stillness is recognizing that I'm here. I can feel myself. I'm grounded, sitting here. I know exactly what I'm doing. I'm talking to you. I'm not thinking about anything else except being here.
Yeah.
And my therapist introduced me to stillness because I was so busy with so many things. And outwardly, people see success. Inwardly, it's chaos because I'm just going. I'm not resting. I haven't slept. And it was only when I was forced to be still with a hospital stay, that's when I realized that I can't tell you what I've been doing the last 2 years. I can tell you now because I've taken stock of what has happened, but stillness is being still enough to hear God.
That's great, because, and I also love what you said about stillness being followed by surrender.
Mm.
I discovered that a few years ago where I had to surrender. I had to be still and surrender. And with that came so much clarity. Mm. As you were saying, suddenly everything becomes clear and you know exactly which yeah. path you're supposed to take and which direction you're supposed to go. Lastly, is there anything else that you would like to, I don't know, expand on, clarify, talk about that I didn't mention that maybe you would like to talk to me about as we wrap up?
No, I think we talked, funny enough, I think we talked about everything.
Really?
Which is crazy because sometimes it's like always something.
Okay, good.
But I really like the fact that you had listened to the episodes as well.
Yes,
so you,
yes. It's,
yeah, but I think you touched on everything. It's been a really beautiful, like, reflective conversation because I'm usually on the other side of the mic these days,
yes.
and not necessarily being the one that's being interviewed. So, yeah, it's
I
been
feel
really
the same
good.
Way, and thank you for saying that. Thanks for making time to be with me here today. And I know you're very busy, and I know you're traveling back soon. So safe travels,
thank
and
you.
I wish you all the best.
Thank you so
this
much.
This was great.
Thank you.